Making Merry, Transcription Poems by Alan Sutherland, from the words of Robin Sojourner. Nake. I remember I was probably only 4, because I think it was definitely before I started school, because I couldn't walk till I was 4, and I could swim before I could walk. I remember being in the front garden with the baby walker and seeing a snake, which I'm sure was a grass snake, but running into the house, and I remember this, going, "It's a nake," and running into the house, leaving the baby walker behind, and then my mum bursting into tears. And it wasn't the fact that there was a snake in the garden, and of course this came to me at some point, you know, later. It was the fact that I'd just run in without using the baby walker. It was a big thing, I guess. Hydro. I remember going to Hydro at the hospital when I was probably 3. I remember what the hospital smelt like, even now. I had some kind of natural affinity with water, which has stayed with me. Not necessarily open water, but water and the suspension that it gives you, the freedom that it offers, the liberation that the water gives me. I seem to remember that the physio said, if you can do 20 lengths of the hydro pool, then she'd buy me this truck, she'd buy me a present. Bribery always works, obviously. And doing it, and it being, okay, right, I've got a truck, sweet. Again, no real comprehensions, other than that the water was just where I loved to be. Dogs. Walking like I do, I used to fall over a lot. I remember falling over in the park, and the first time I put my hands through dog shit. I've never liked dogs since. Just one of those things, coupled with the fact that, certainly when I walked in those days, I had a really jerky, inconsistent walk that a dog couldn't get the measure of. So it used to freak dogs out, and then they would bark and jump or whatever. I was unstable, and then I'd get knocked over. So me and dogs, it's not a personal thing, it's more of a physical thing. School. The story goes that because I've got an elder sister who's 18 months older than me but a school year above, when it was time for me to be looking at schools, they went, well, he'll have to go to a special school. And my dad's like, why? Well, because the child is a spastic child, would have been the term. And my dad's like, well, he's just as clever as his sister. Why does he need to go to a different school? And anyway, in the end, my dad said, look, he's coming here. And then they put me on probation. 4, 4.5, or whatever it was, I was on probation. One morning in the PE lesson, the headmaster came into the school and was looking into the hall. Where's Robin? And the teacher went, up there. I was hanging with one hand. You remember they used to have those big, thick ropes, the big, thick rope like they use for tug of war. And I just pulled myself up hand over hand, you know, and it's just like, yo! Apparently, at that point, the teacher said, well, fair enough, if he can do that, then why are we worried about him being in school? Park life. The first primary school, I was aware of my differences, but I just did whatever. Because to the friends I'd grown up with, I was just Robin. If I needed help climbing through the bush because they'd locked that park gate, then they would help me climb through the bush. It was just brothers in arms, as it were. I got up to what every other 6 or 7 or 8 year old wanted to get up to. I read Swallows and Amazons, and there wasn't a lake, there wasn't a broad in the middle of Reading, so we had to make do with the park and stuff. We had a railway line we weren't supposed to go near, so we always did. Trees to climb that you were not supposed to be able to. So we did. Differentials. Going to a mainstream school, there's things went on, presented particular issues, more so at secondary than primary. And so I did the swimming. That was the thing. That was my thing. I swam. I remember winning the swimming races, even those days. Most children of 5 and 6 aren't particularly good at swimming. As you get older, the swimmers start developing. Differentials increase. Not the skills or the quality, but the speed differentials. But then I'd got this whole other thing going on. I'm not going to say I'm cleverer than my sister, because that really would be wrong. We have different intellectual capacities. She's studious and erudite, whereas I like to think that I'm quick-witted and mischievous. I did once join Mensa. I got in. I've got a piece of paper somewhere with my IQ of 157 or whatever it is written on it. The point of that being whatever intellect I have is generally for making merry rather than academia. So I was always in trouble. No man's land. When we went to Hong Kong, we were in a forces school. That's a different dynamic. And of course, when you come back to a mainstream non-forces school, you're always the outsider. So then being an outsider and having an impairment is kind of, right, that's your double whammy, you know? I think you can quite easily become the stranger, l'étranger, in situations like that. I always found myself in a sort of no man's land a lot of the time, not necessarily fitting in to the camp of the non-disabled, the able-bodied, but also not necessarily the camp of the handicapped. I use that word quite deliberately in this context, because that's who you were seen as. And if you weren't cap in hand, you weren't asking, you weren't looking for help, then you were being rude or whatever. So I do identify with this group of people who had things done for them, but then didn't really identify with the majority of, you know, 11, 12-year-olds at this point. As a child, even though I walked, I used my arms for everything, even in walking. Because I couldn't walk, I used to just walk on my hands. Imagine a press-up, but dragging your feet behind you, kind of like a seal. Hopefully slightly more gracefully, maybe, but that was it. Even at 8, 9, 10, my shoulders were twice the size of my waist. That's what the girls like to see. Blonde hair and muscly arms. And so I had all this strength. I could do that kind of stuff and haul myself up walls. If I could reach the top, I could get up it. If I could reach the branch, I could get up to the next one kind of thing. Because there was just all power. We weren't, you know, in the swallows and Amazons sense. We weren't naughty kids, not that way. I've never been, certainly at that age, particularly naughty. Just mischievous. Capacity. I can probably be honest and say that there were points in my time where I was quite rebellious. But I think it was that kind of the transition from infant school to the army school. Because at 6 and 7 it was fine. Their expectations of a 6-year-old child who walks funny and another 6-year-old child don't manifest themselves in the same way. But when you get to 9 and 10, they think that you're stupid because you walk funny. And then the whole expectation of who you are and what you're going to produce change. And then I became badly behaved. not having my capacity recognised. There were certain teachers who did, and then they'd get really annoyed. But generally my whole schooling career was based around not having my intellectual capacity recognised. So I got bored and just took the piss. Hong Kong. We lived in this block of flats, two apartments to a floor, and it was like three double bedrooms. Plus, we used to have an armar. That was just what people did. They had armars, which was a female Hong Kong servant. All the sights and smells, when you see pictures on telly of markets in Hong Kong, they are so like that. All the produce is alive in bowls, and the fish market was amazing. So we lived in this big apartment, and we had the armour, and then we used to call him the chewing gum man, but he was actually the fish salesman. And for the boys, he would have a bag full of frozen fish eyes, which you could play marbles with till they thawed out. It was just a thing. But of course, they're not completely round, so they don't roll the same either. We lived in this 20-storey block of flats, and we learned that you could climb onto the roof of the veranda of the 20th-storey flat and look over. That makes me quiver even now, thinking about it, because I hate heights. On the beach. I started my swimming career in hydro, but then we went to live in Hong Kong for 3 years, and fundamentally you went to school for as little time as possible. Then you went in the sea or a swimming pool, which meant that you went to the beach. It was on the edge of the kind of jungle where the trees grow into the beach, and there are all these billions of places to go and play action men in. You know, and sail your action men and take them diving and have them climbing trees and falling off rocks. Action men were big in my life, it's got to be said. And of course, being a swimmer, that was great, and I could always hold my breath longer than most people. So I could take my action man down deep and talk to him under the water and do all sorts of underwater action man-y things as well. The beach was 10 minutes by however I got there in those days. I can't remember, took a trike or mum helped carry me. I'm sure I didn't go in a pram in those days. How I walk. If you imagine I was walking down the road, and every step there was a bollard that I had to swing my legs round, that's about my walk how it used to be. But as I did it, I would turn my feet over. So I would scratch, so I would almost, I'd walk across the top of my foot. So, of course, Clark's Commandos, other shoes are available, were the school shoe de rigueur. And I would wear them through in 2 days, because I would just literally scrape the top off the shoe. My dad managed to somehow, I don't know where he got this idea from, but a way of attaching, making like fiberglass resin toe caps on the outside of my shoes. I just hated it because I looked such a twat. Because I had these big things like bits of resin on the outside of my shoe. And yes, it did stop me from ripping my way through shoes, but I hated it, absolutely hated it. But I can't walk in bare feet because I would literally scrape the top of my feet off. Orthopedics. When I was in Hong Kong, there's a place called the Duchess of Kent Royal Orthopaedic Hospital. It was local, you know, in Sandy Bay. I have a gazillion questions around disability and medicine and repairing versus not repairing. For me, the issue is the attempt at normalisation. For me, that's the biggie. That's where the big problem lies. I had some operations at this hospital. It was world famous because that was where they did This guy, I can't remember his name, but he pioneered this operation for straightening out spines. A lot of children in Hong Kong got polio, and it resulted in curvature of the spine. And then they invented this operation. Kids would be in a hospital for 2 years. They'd have sort of a metal hoop literally bolted onto their hips, and a metal hoop that was screwed onto the skull, and then bars joining them vertically, which could be a bit like a rack, really. They would be unscrewed every so often to make the bar that little bit longer to pull the back out. I mean, it was horrible, the pain that people went through. Because you'd have to, you know, try sleeping wearing two metal rings and stuff like that. I do remember, and I know other people who've had this experience, the amount of photographs I had taken of me in underpants. And sometimes you wondered why. I would not want to malign any doctor, but it's still, you know, if I think that somewhere there are pictures of me in my pants. It's a strange one, really. Rebuild. I had tendon lengthening operations, which again ended up being in casts for ages and ages. Basically, if you imagine a piece of licorice or something, what they do is they don't cut it in half, like perpendicular to the length. They slice it down like a runner bean would be sliced, and then slide the two halves apart, so they would rejoin at the bottom, but then they'd be longer. Then you'd be in casts, so it would give the tendon the chance to rebuild itself. It's kind of like splicing. So you'd get a thin bit, and that would then have to rebuild to give it its strength. It's been months in cast, and then lots of physio. And I just hated it. It was so obvious that it wasn't really ever going to make any difference. So what was the point of it? To make you walk more like everybody else? Well, fuck that, really. In the end, it was just a lot of pain without really any gain, and I think it was about trying to make me walk better, but morally, was that the right thing to do? Would be the question. And not one I aimed at my parents. My parents are fab, actually. They're extremely patient, I think. It's not like, oh, they were allowed to operate on me, they allowed it to happen. I don't see it like that. There wasn't a collusion or anything negative like that. It was, well, we think this can help. They thought it would, and they're told, well, actually, it'll make him be able to be more like his sister. Or whatever. The trouble with physio. Physio as a rehabilitative tool is great. If you've broken your leg, if you've pulled your back, whatever, you've gone from a stable position. Something's happened, and you need to get back to that stable position. Cool. But I don't need rehabilitating. Any need to habilitate is really not based on any physical need whatsoever. Upon moral, philosophical, political, or socio-economic, maybe. But actually, from the physical perspective, none. You know, don't get me wrong. If there was a cure for my hereditary spastic paraparesis, and it meant that I didn't have to put up with the discomfort, fine, I would probably be there. But not for any of the reasons that other people think, that you need to be able-bodied, you need to be like that, you need to be productive in this way. That's just bollocks. I don't need anyone to feel sorry for me. I don't need power relationships in my life that are based on other people's interpretation of what they think I can do in my life. I think that a lot of children have missed out on childhood by being made to do physio and being made to take drugs that have dampened their cognitive capacities. I walked as a child a lot. Physio, and the damage physio has done to me, is a long-term effect as opposed to a short-term gain. It's a major issue when it comes to my politics. Talking to girls. The transition when we came back from Hong Kong was 6 months to go into secondary school, into a new school. All the boys are starting puberty, you know, all would have football prowess and stuff like that. And you came back and didn't have that, but was always very good at talking to girls, which always got me in trouble. I certainly learnt how to talk to girls in a way that girls like being talked to, if that makes sense. And in a friendship way, not in a manipulative way. Older, story changes. Like with everybody, I'm sure, but you know, at that age, it's about, well, you've got to make friends with somebody. And actually, the girls were a lot less morally or socially judgmental. Punk. In the broadest sense, I got into being a punk. I mean, I had many coloured hairs, I got my ears pierced. I was the first boy at school to have my ear pierced. That's who I was. It's like, shit, I could get my ear pierced. And then when everyone started getting their ear pierced, I then got both done. And then it was like, you're gay then, aren't you, mate? Okay, if that's what you want to think what you want. I know I'm not, but I could have been. But I didn't care. And it was just to give a big finger to the authorities, because you weren't allowed to wear earrings to school, so I did. And then I wore two, and I was told to take them out, and I never did. Then I put another one in. So I ended up, I had two in one and one in the other. I had blue hair, green hair, pink hair, purple hair, bleached hair. I never had a proper Mohican, but I was a swimmer. It simply made no sense to have a Mohican, because when you're in a swimming pool 4 or 5 times a week or whatever, a haircut like that is just in the way. So I always had short, spiky, scruffy, messed up kind of hair. Back pain. I remember when I went to uni, I was having really, really bad back problems. And my back problems stemmed from how I was made to walk, or from walking, shall we say. The biggest issue of my life is back pain right now, has been since I was a teenager. It's not about how far I can walk and all that shit, it's the pain and what that does to sleep patterns and all the rest of it. I'd just started uni as a mature student, and I'd kind of got switched over to the doctors in Birmingham. Ah, well, we'd better see you at the orthopaedic. And they went, well, maybe some baclofen. I felt stupid for 3 days. If that sounds offensive, I apologise to anyone. It was like someone had put like a sort of, you know, a not quite opaque plastic bag inside my head, so that everything was distant and like a fog. Not a fog on the outside, but a fog on the inside. I think what it did was probably made me forget that I was in pain, or not be able to recognise that I was in pain. There was no reparatory constituent of it at all. I think it just dulled who you were. I thought, nah, but if that's what they're putting kids through in school, well, I know that they do. They wonder why kids, you see lots of kids dragging around special schools looking like they're vacant because they've been drugged up. And we know people that have been through that. You and I, not going to name any, but I mean we know people who are creators of great contemporary work who as kids was seen as not being able to think properly. And it was down to the fact that they were drugged up to their eyeballs. down the Swanee. I got prescribed tramadol, and I remember taking it now, jumping around a bit, you know. I had as misspent a youth as anyone who didn't end up a drug addict, but I remember taking tramadol and then having horrendous lucid dreams, and waking up after the first time taking them, and my body going, "Have another one of those." And I'm like, "It ain't right. This can't be right." So I decided not to take any more, but the next night, being in pain from preparatory surgery on my shoulders through all the swimming and pushing the chair, so I still believe in that end of things, but then going, "Whoa, I'll have to deal with the pain some other way." I didn't actually realise until only the other day. I was watching Designated Survivor, because all truth comes out of fiction, that tramadol's actually an opiate. I didn't realise it was an opiate-based painkiller. Perhaps I should have looked, but that makes so much sense to my head. Because cocodamol, I do the same, which I know is codeine-based. And I'd recognised the thing. But they give you them, they don't go, "Be careful," like, you know, "Take as many as you need to keep the pain away." Hello? If you have the propensity to have an addiction of that sort, then you'd be so easily down the Swanee. Ireland. We left Hong Kong when my dad got a 2-year posting to Northern Ireland. And we were there just 6 months. It was not a nice time to be there, 74. It was a difficult time. I can remember being spat at in the face by a child who knew I couldn't chase after him and kick the shit out of him because, whether I would have or not, I couldn't, for being a Protestant army kid. I got over it. I married a Catholic girl. But I mean the things that you remember. I remember Ireland being a beautiful country, but then going into Belfast, and people with machine guns, and things you couldn't drive through with a car, and sentry posts. Some of that stuff is still there and still quite prevalent, still quite obvious, you know. I mean, the wall art is amazing. You know, there's some of the paintings, incredible paintings. What they depict is a bit more contentious, but the art as a pure base of expression is amazing. But actually, at that time, I don't think I can remember having any negative experiences, strangely enough, from a disabled perspective, or as a disabled child at that point. We came back after we'd been there for 6 months. My dad's like, "I don't want you here." There was a kid down the road whose dad's leg was blown to bits by a pillarbox bomb and things like that. "I don't want you staying here." So he would fly out to Belfast on the Sunday night and then fly back to where my parents still live, in Camberley, in Frimley, Surrey, and fly back to Heathrow on a Friday. As a child, fishing was my relaxation. Along with writing. So I started writing as an angst. 12, 13-year-old was when I first thought about using words. And then punk happened, which was like an epiphany. I had this swimming career which I kept going through all of the things I shouldn't have done in my life. I think, actually, if it hadn't been for my swimming career, I probably would be dead by now. Because I still managed to do a lot of things I shouldn't have done. But I had this swimming as an anchor. I learnt to ride a push bike. Again, it's the most unsightly version of riding a push bike because it was all from my shoulders. I would literally go down the road by pushing one shoulder down to make the other knee come up. So then the bike would go 40 degrees one way, and then I'd use my shoulder to literally, you know, like when you see them doing the mountain climb on the Tour de France. My dad used to say, "If I go past you in the car, I think how bad this must look for any other driver on the road. Rushmore Mallards. My dad had already done lifeguarding or whatever and decided we needed to go to somewhere that offered me some more swimming than just hydro or whatever was available. And then we joined a club called the Rushmore Mallards. At the time, the majority of disability sports clubs were held on Sunday lunchtimes, because that's when no one else wanted to swim. But for me, it was only a good place. And then I did my first junior nationals when I was 12. I could already swim really, really well. From then on in, it was learning to train. I'd got this amazing fitness and stamina base. I'd been taught to swim by army instructors. And my dad, who also learned how to become a swimming teacher, and then coach, and then umpire, referee, and everything else you could be in the world of swimming, to support the club that we were then part of. I almost lived this parallel existence. There was Robin the swimmer, Robin the mischievous schoolboy come fisher person, and Robin the school-hating boy. I hated school so, so much. The incandescent headmaster. I remember my headmaster being hauled in front of him for the umpteenth time, and him being absolutely incandescent because I'd done something wrong yet again, but he couldn't give me the cane because he feared that giving me the cane was going to somehow be bad for my impairment. I did not disabuse him. My dad wasn't shy of smacking. Again, it's an age. My dad smacked me. Yes, it was a pointless exercise, but that's how things were done 50 years ago. I don't have a problem with it. I've never smacked my kids, or once, maybe, once. I remembered how futile it was. I think that the relationship I had with school would have been tainted a lot earlier. So by the time I'm old enough to recognise those things, I was just already a badly behaved schoolboy. I became a self-fulfilling prophecy. I was the wise ass in the class. But there were certain teachers that were really annoyed by this, would be like, oh, I'm so disappointed, because you're a clever bloke, you know? Eventually, I got a degree in philosophy. Bloody nuisance. I ended up having a kind of brain bleed, which was a result of a combination of slipping over on ice while drunk and banging the back of my head, and drinking far too much, and probably some other things. I just remember it hurting, then woke up with my head stuck to the pillow, and then about 4 days later my mum came into the lounge to find me swallowing my tongue. Got rushed to hospital and then to Atkinson Morley, which was a hospital in Wimbledon for brain injuries. And I can remember it being so annoying, being in a really ungrateful way, because every hour they'd come and wake you up and go, who's the Prime Minister? What's the capital of France? It's still Margaret fucking Thatcher. Who do you think it is? Unfortunately. And then being back in the pool 3 weeks later, because I had the Paralympics to swim in 1988. Full circle. I've swum in 3 Paralympics, couple of world championships, umpteen world records. Don't want this to come across as immodest. I have this collection of things that I did. But also managed to be badly behaved, enjoy sexual freedom of being a teenager and a young adult, coupled with being in a band and touring in a band and being played on John Peel, which was, back in the day, was amazing. We never got a live session, but he played our music, you know. I'm still now, it's kind of full circle. I'm coaching, and I'm coaching my daughter, who is a would-be Paralympic swimmer. I do arts and equality training. And yet I still perform, and I still go out there, and I still take no prisoners, less so now. Faster, higher, stronger. One of the casualties of the positive changes around inclusion is the loss of some segregated activities. And where the segregated activities gave people the self-esteem and confidence to go on to other things. People who would never, even now, be able to simply go to a public swimming session or join a local swimming club or local archery club or a local table tennis club because the differential would be so big. There is then no competitive differential to allow them to be able to take part, to then get to the point where you can become as good an athlete as you can be for who you are. The principle of the Paralympics is the same as the Olympics, faster, higher, stronger. The Paralympics is exactly the same. All it does is takes into consideration that you are being the fastest or highest or strongest that you can be. And then there's got to be some kind of strata to allow that, to categorise so that it's then fair. If I joined Rushmore Royals, which was the able-bodied swimming club in Farnborough, I could never have competed for them because I'm a very, very good swimmer for a swimmer with no leg kick. But then you put me against a 12-year-old who's a trained swimmer with a leg kick, it's not going to happen. Every town used to have a disability sports club, under the auspices of what was called the British Sports Association for the Disabled. We lived in Surrey. We had our club. That was in Farnborough. Reading had a club. Basingstoke had a club. Windsor had a club. Woking had a club. Croydon had a club. Guildford had a club. Southampton had a club. Wantage had a club. What is now British Paralympics came out of that setup. But that setup doesn't exist anymore in the same way as it did. British Swimming are now finally taking it on board. But if you look at who they took to the last two or three Paralympics, they were the swimmers that were as able-bodied as you can get. They were the top three, four classes. Swimmers that, when they swim, they approximate to able-bodied swimming. And we've still got swimmers who are just completely left behind because they did not fit the perception. Disability sport, certainly swimming, and even track stuff, went through this normalisation of you're good if you look able-bodied. So yeah, Tanny Gray uses a wheelchair, but she presents as someone who's acceptable, if that makes sense. Lady Godiva. Lady Godiva. I took part in lots of protests. There's a great picture of me as Lady Godiva going through Coventry. There's me and Tom Comerford at the front of a march through Coventry in our chairs, but wearing these wigs made out of yellow wool. It was a kind of joint protest. It was a disability thing. And it was at the same time as they were bringing in pension charges, local authorities charging pensioners for care. And we managed for once to actually bring another body of disgruntled citizens. It was a joint thing. So for those that don't know, listeners, Lady Godiva's protest was about taxes. That was why she rode through the streets of Coventry naked as a protest to her husband. And so myself and Tom Comerford Lady Godiva'd ourselves and headed this march through Coventry, naked except for woolen hair, and marched, or rather rolled, to the council house, and then blockaded the council house. Poetry in Motion. I started as a poet just trying to write things about. Poetry seemed a way to express what I was feeling. I didn't want to hit anybody. I didn't want to break stuff. But I found that actually I could get really passionate, you know, and I can be writing and make myself cry, actually be that upset by what I'm writing. The context of what I'm writing about, or really cross, that fuels the creativity, you know. Sometimes words then pour by the gazillion and you can't write them fast enough. And other times you do. You've got to metaphorically bang your head on the wall to find that word, because that word matters. I was doing that, and then punk came out, and I would sit upstairs in my bedroom. I didn't play an instrument at this point. I'd done a bit of classical guitar learning and hated it. Hated the structure, hated the sound, I didn't hate the teacher, but I hated the teaching. Because it's just not me. I had a metal waste paper basket which came from the BP garage. So you can imagine hitting that with a pair of drumsticks. And I would put on, first of all, Deep Purple. Not talking about Smoke on the Water, but much more punky, aggressive, Speed King and stuff like that that you could lose yourself in. And of course then, when punk came out, you could swear as well. Whoa! Obsession. I wasn't a performing poet as such. I was just a productive poet because it worked for me. Whilst I have never been diagnosed as having a mental health issue, I am very aware that I have managed my mental health a lot of the time through writing. And at certain points through alcohol, but then that just proved to be disruptive. As we all know, but it's easy to say that in hindsight. It didn't ruin my swimming career, but it could have ruined everything, you know. Even now, the biggest driver for me is psychological. I'm an obsessed writer. Band. I had all these poems. I don't have an avenue to read them. And I want to be more organized also. So I went back to how I'd listened to punk and what people could say, and I thought, well, okay, I could do that in my own way. So then I got hold of an electric guitar and decided to learn to teach myself to play it. Very badly, mostly, in those days. I'm a bit better now. And then made a band and just started doing stuff. What is disability art? It is art that expresses my experiences of life as a disabled person and my interpretations of other people's experiences, not in a vicarious way, but in an understanding, empathetic way. We'd do things in local pubs, and in those days I was being looked at really, really strangely. A bloke in a wheelchair playing guitar. Or if I stood up looking really odd because I stand really awkwardly. So I did all that, and I got better and better at playing the guitar, and kept writing. Dan Dare's Dog. My reason I went to Birmingham had nothing to do with the fact that it was a red brick university, or Russell Group, or whatever it's now known as. It was that I'd got a place as a guitarist in a band, because my mate had gone to Birmingham, and his best mate was a drummer in a band. The band he was in, which were called Dan Dare's Dog, had just lost their guitarist and wanted a new one. So I then auditioned and got in there. Then I spent 4 years playing in the band, but not really. I was writing poetry, but I wasn't. We were an indie band. It wasn't a disability arts thing. I was just a musician in a band who happened to be a disabled person. I actually think it did hold us back, because we were really, really good and had so many great reviews, but I didn't look right. And it was in those days, in the late 80s, early 90s, when how you looked was so important. I couldn't ever say that that was genuinely the case, but the music we played still holds up now. We were front runners, mood shapers, ahead of the game, doing grunge like Nirvana, indie with drama. We were doing stuff like that before it was big over here, but we'd all grown up listening to more left field, kind of anarcho-punk alternative music. And then we split up as a band. That's just what happens with uni bands. And apart from writing poetry, I didn't do much. But was much, much more involved in the disability rights scene by this point. Get Back. I'd had this bit of hiatus of doing public arty things other than writing in the book. And then a really good friend died in hospital when he really shouldn't have. He'd gone in for an operation. I mean, he was a tetraplegic, paralysed from the neck down, 24-hour care and stuff, but he was still really active in the disability rights world. And he'd gone in to have some simple intervention and died of an infection. It just shouldn't have been allowed to happen, but it did. I was asked to do something at his funeral, and that was what rekindled writing and playing. And then I'm like, okay, I can do this, get back into it. And at that point, things, that sort of mid-90s to the early 2000s, were a big time for disability arts. So I was on that thing. I never did a lot in London. I never did Jackson's Lane. I think I might have done one glad thing. But I was in Birmingham, and communication was different in those days, you know. And you had Alan Holdsworth performing as Johnny Crescendo. Alan was dominant. He wasn't the only one, but as singer-songwriter, they didn't need anyone other than Alan. Because he was just there, you know, and Alan's great. I remember going to Hull for a Dan Action come BCODP meeting, and Alan playing, and me thinking I could be doing this as well. I'd met Alan years ago because he'd done something for One in Four. I'd been kind of re-engaged with art as a performance thing through Dan and the BCODP stuff, and then kind of went on from that, really. Then wrote a lot more, did a lot of stuff as a singer-songwriter. Different to Alan's. He's very good at that anthem, mixing alongy thing, whereas mine's much more, I tell stories. If you look at any of my songs, they're not every one of them, obviously, but a lot of them are little stories that have a beginning, a tail, and an end. And usually it's some kind of long dilemma, disability rights, educative. If you're a non-disabled person hearing this, it's telling you what you should be doing. If you're a disabled person hearing this, it should be edifying. And then, at the end, happy ever after. Or not. Depending how the song goes. And so that's how I write songs, and that's how I like doing the short stories. If you ever do see me live, even the stuff we're doing as a band now, that structure is there. But it's trying to couch it so that you don't feel you've been preached to. I learned a lot from Alan. He always gave me a lot of work when he could, because what he recognised was that I had trod the boards. I've done all the time. I think he recognised that politically we were on the same perspectives, disability politics and stuff. But that I also wasn't someone who'd just come out of the woodwork, expecting to be paid 500 quid because I'd come down on a train from somewhere and done a poem. He knew that I'd spent 15 years playing in bands and doing this and doing that, so actually getting paid for something was an absolute revelation. I remember the first ever disability gig I got paid for as an individual artist was like, wow, it was incredible. It was that sense of value. It's not about how much you got paid. And it's gone so far back from that now. People want everything for nothing, and they think that you should be pleased. It's gone back to, well, you should be pleased that we're letting you in. Mine won't stand up in my hand. There were two early pieces that I wrote that became performed by others. There was one called Mine Won't Stand Up in My Hand. It was done with a group of people, the majority of whom were recovering from having had strokes, life-changing strokes. And it was a whole take on that Diet Coke advert about, you know, the kind of sounds a bit bizarre, but you know, the women in the Diet Coke lusting after somebody, and then this guy used to be a kind of virile builder guy. And this was all about real people, but again, taking their experiences and building it into a narrative. You know, he loves Diet Coke, but he can't get an erection anymore. So it's kind of a pretty white-knuckle ride if you're the wrong person. It was written as a piece that was then delivered with the people, but as a question to front workshops and question and answer sessions about understanding disability and relating to it, whether that's from other disabled people or health professionals or whatever. Truth Heals. Josh would have been about 10, maybe, and we were involved in Stagecoach. The principal of the school knew that I had started writing again, but she said it would be really great to have a piece, an original piece, because we don't get original pieces. So then I wrote this play, which was entered into the then Birmingham and Solihull Theatre Guild Festival. I wrote this play, which was about a load of kids at a theatre school going to a summer camp. Then it focuses on a relationship between the guy who's a wheelchair user and the girl who seems to be the principal of everything, but when they go on this camp, suddenly becomes really withdrawn and has always got her headphones on. It uses this kind of Romeo and Juliet on the balcony kind of moment of him talking to her and then opening up to each other. And he's about his worries about how people see him as a wheelchair user, whether he's fanciable. So it's a very teenage thing. And then her opening up to him that the reason she always learns her lines and the reason she's always got her headphones on like this is because she has dyslexia. So she gets all her scripts sent to her on tape, but has never told anybody this. And then how this opening up of who they are to each other is the healing element of it. So taking the nuances of learning or the nuances of the relationships you have as a disabled person as positive ones. For me, it was a really pivotal piece of writing that made me realise that I could write something that was a bit more substantial, but still kept my core ethos of disabled people helping each other to empower themselves or empower each other within the scenario. Paying for poetry. Jew and I have talked about this, that so many disabled artists are having to not be artists because they simply can't afford to anymore. A lot of my work, what enabled me to be an artist, was that I got a lot of work as an empowerment trainer, an arts and empowerment trainer. And of course, the arse has fallen out of being an arts and empowerment trainer, because it's not that there isn't a call for it. I could give myself away 24 hours a day for nothing, but ask for some money for it. We can't pay for that, and it's not really important enough. And how do you argue? We haven't got enough money to pay for personal assistance to change people's, you know, grown adults' pants when they didn't get to a toilet in time. How can we justify, therefore, paying for poetry? My one regret. My one regret is I never got to meet Ian Dury. I was meant to, and something happened. I think it was an insecurity issue, and I never went, because he was always my hero. But as a punk, not as a disabled person. I think as well as a disabled person. If there's anyone that my songwriting is akin to, and again, I'm not trying to measure myself against him, but just stylized-wise, it's about telling stories. That's where I get my songwriting and storytelling. It's Ian Dury-esque. Poetry and songwriting is about where you're splitting your sentence at a given point. So you split the sentence, but it's still delivered so that you get the 2 points of the sentence to give you the rhyming or the syncopation or whatever. I'm a very untechnical poet. So that actually you think the line's finished, but it hasn't, because you carry it on with the next line. Angry Fish. I'd been doing lots of stuff around disability art for a long, long time in various things. You know, music, poetry, whatever. And then I decided that I wanted to put together an album, and I wanted a name. Angry Fish is a combination of 3 things as a start point. Me as a swimmer, and with a name like Surgeoner, I've been called Sturgeon many, many, many times. And probably, maybe some of that, but obviously from a political, you know, disability art, politics side of it, I do have a bit of anger, shall we say, frustration and anger. And it stuck. I just used it. There have been 2 incarnations of Angry Fish the band. So that's me with other people coming in and doing various bits. I put out an advert for disabled musicians to create a band. And so we ended up with a band of 4. 4 guys, but not by intention, it's just you can only come back to who applies. It was me, Phil on drums, who's blind and looks like he was in ZZ Top. He'll be 72 this year, I think, and still plays like a young rocker. And I know the impairments aren't particularly relevant, but just for making it sense, the bass player's a guy called Ian, who lost a leg as a teenager. And then the other guitar player, who's a guy called Sam, who's late 20s and has Asperger's, other kind of spectrum-y stuff. He's also a songwriter and singer. So Angry Fish as an entity is a kind of malleable thing. The Y Festival. The whole point of the Y Festival, right from its inception, was providing safe opportunities for disabled people who are not at this point necessarily artists, giving them safe learning, creative performance opportunities. So my rationale all the way through it was about creating new opportunities for new up-and-coming and, wherever it was appropriate, mid-career artists to perform, to have the opportunity to work together, to create collaboratively, and deliver performance pieces. Funders forget the me and yous of this world, that are artists who want to just do their art and want to help other people become the artists that they could be, or even don't yet know that they could be, by offering those really kind of small windows of opportunity. There's a poet now called Cooley Coley, who had been doing some poetry, had written lots of poetry, but would not perform them. She's a 40-something, maybe even 50-something-year-old Asian woman with CP, married, got kids. She's written her own backstory. You don't need that from me. So she came along and she said, I could do all this, write all those things, but will you perform them for me? And I went, no, no, I won't. Not in a horrible way. You can do it. She said, I can't, I can't. Without going through the whole process, I gave her the confidence that she's doing trips to foreign places, reading her poetry. So, you know, I've been completely usurped. She sends me everything, and as always, I didn't help her particularly. I didn't help her as a poet. I helped her as a performer of poetry. But she's gone on. Robert Punton. I don't know if you know Robert. He's now operating as Robert Punton or the Bitterfly. Sort of play on butterfly. Again, he had CP, got speech issues. But he's now recorded a 30-track poetry CD in my place. He did his first course with me 10 years ago, probably. And then he did All the Things We Could Have Been. And it's like, I can do this. But without opportunities, like I've always tried to offer, those people, they may not have found themselves. And this opportunity to be who they are inside, without that kind of safe environment to do it. In terms of current output, I'm writing, but I'm writing in a way that's just, it's very organic. I mean, my writing's mostly been organic anyway. But it's like, you know, there are bits, and they're very kind of acerbic. Occasional vitriol, if that wasn't a contradiction. I'm full of occasional vitriol. But I suppose without compromising the quality of it. Because what I don't want to do is just become Angry Fish actually is Angry Poet. Because I'm not. So although the name suggests it, there needs to be a turning point in the conception of angry to actually creatively, constructively positive. There you go. Festival. I went to see Ruth Gould, and we spent a lot of time chatting. She was really good, really supportive, said she'd mentor any ideas I'd got. So that was great, but it was the ideas I've already talked about doing a mix of bringing in some established artists to when you've got your performance ready. The idea is that, like any support act, you're coming in, and you've got an audience because someone's come to see somebody bigger than you. That's the theory. A bit later, Ruth contacted me and said, can you come and see me? I've been asked to throw together a strategic funding thing, looking at the 6 areas of lowest engagement in the arts, which included the Black Country. She liked the whole concept of it. So she then built the concept that I'd put together into being a sort of foundational bit of this National Disability Arts project. So I was invited, from having had this original concept, to then be the linchpin for anything in the Black Country. I embraced what I was going to do for the West Midlands. I needed to come up with a name, and I came up with the Y Festival. Why? My concept is that the Why Festival is not about why not. Why is a much bigger question. Why are you doing this? Why haven't you done it? Why aren't you doing it? Why can you do it? Why shouldn't you do it? How? Why is that what you're doing? It was meant to be a positive why. Why can't I? Why shouldn't I? Not why aren't you? It's meant as a much more positive reflection on, perhaps effectively, the same questions to some degree. And so all the stuff I then did under the strategic touring grant in the Black Country was done as the Y Festival. Glass House. We ended up doing an event at a really great venue called the Glass House in Stourbridge. It was a college for young adults with non-neurotypical behaviours and kind of associations. So there were some kids with physical impairments, young adults, sort of range of people. But this college was a tertiary place about learning, but learning about art skills and using glass. So the glass house is still there. It's like a got lots of mini workshops for contemporary artisans. It's a really, really interesting place. But it's also got histories of glass in the area and all kinds of things. They also have this incredible performance space, because the college students, as part of the broader bit of what they were doing performancey type things, or had the space to do it. So you got DJs and all kind of manner of things going on. I was able to put in local artists. But then we had the touring artists that came in, Crip Hop and Gareth Berliner and Karuna Stammel, as the sort of headline acts. But it was so difficult to sell space, to get people to them. Then brought in all these other artists, like the local artists who were just chuffed to be getting an opportunity. I massively, massively underpriced it to get it under the 15 grand for effectively a two-year project. So most of it I did for free. We built on it and then did loads of work around it. Lots and lots of workshops. But then bringing that all together came all the bits of all the things we could have been. Workshops. What I got really good at was getting people to sit in a place, brainstorm, come up with a few ideas, then work on those ideas so that we'd end up with so many flip charts or whatever and drawings. And my cartooning got better. It's still crap, but often you got people who don't have reading skills or good reading skills. So being able to use pictures as well. And then kind of collating those together, and all through agreement, saying, okay, well, this means this. So as a set of words, because obviously a lot of people who don't have English, written English, you know, reading and writing, still have a reasonable understanding of the spoken English. So then putting it all together and coming up with, you know, saying, well, this picture, that word, those things, this means we want to choose what we want to do. And then you literally put in building blocks. The bit that I would do generally, I would take what I usually classed as my box of hitty-bangy things and occasional blowy things. I would come up with, what mood do we want? Do you want this to be a slow song? Do you want this to be a jumpy up and down song? And then produce a simple set of chords that would drive a melody. The whole point of it was about empowering people to do something different and to think about themselves in a different way. And I would say to people, I want you to be creative. And if at the end of the day, all you've done is go, ah! And we've got that recorded in some way, that is as valid a contribution as I wandered lonely as a cloud. Because it's your contribution about you and your relationship with the world. And if at the end of the day, all you've done is go, ah, and we've got that recorded in some way, that is as valid a contribution as I wandered lonely as a cloud. Because it's your contribution about you and your relationship with the world. Permission to speak. I did a lot of workshops which were called Permission to Speak. Very much exactly what I'm talking about. And this is when Robert Punton came on, and other people who are now doing bigger things, and some who just really, really enjoyed the experience. That was through local authority funding, when it still existed. So they ended up in workshops. I did a whole series of workshops in the bottom of the ICC in Symphony Hall in Birmingham. It was a great place, because sometimes places, just being there, give you a sense of, oh, I can be artistic here, because of where it is. So it would be a series of days of building up about how they work. And there was never any prescription about what people had to do, but I always had a bass guitar. I always had a guitar and some hitty-bangy things. So people would then choose what they wanted to create. They might just want to do spoken word. Or it might have gone, well, can you help me write? Can you turn this into a short song or whatever? So that was permission to speak. It wasn't about saying you can talk now at all. It was about the whole political notion of who you are, and it's okay to have questions about how you're treated and how you engage with society because of barriers. All the things we could have been. 1. Then I had this idea to write a one-man show, which became, I invented the title right at the beginning, so it was one of those few things where the title came first. All the Things We Could Have Been. It's taken my story, and lots of other people's stories that I understand, or had tangential relationships with, or whatever, and my understanding of the world as I see it, to create this kind of story arc, which goes from being a completely misunderstood teenager to coming out the other end of it, as a self-determined artist, agent provocateur, disability activist, whatever. It's a kind of rite of passage thing, from being a disabled child and being treated as a disabled child, through to, at some point, finding out who you are and starting to stand up for who you are. So I wrote All the Things We Could Have Been. I'd made the decision that I wanted to be able to perform it as a solo show and be as portable as possible. So I designed it around, I would write the piece, I would create, any scenery would be portable, and that I could put up as a wheelchair user. And that I could literally perform solo without wanting to compromise, compromising as little access as I could. The whole show ended up as a solo performance. The whole play is set in a pub called The Hasty and the Hurting, and it's the pub that's next door to the Pearly Gates. I play both the landlord and the narrator and the performer. Behind me, running on a video screen, is what looks like a stage, with The Hasty and the Hurting written across the back of it. And then there's a sign language interpreter filmed, already doing the sign language of my performance. But I'd made all of those decisions, that was how I would do it, before I'd written it, so then I had to work out how on earth I write something that I can pace with the sign language going on behind me. So it's all written in, almost entirely in couplets, but some really, really complicated ones that do bear out as you get through them. I really didn't compromise at all on any of the rhymes to get me the story that I wanted to give. The underlying idea that I'd written it, or half the reason I'd written it that way, was so that I could then give myself a meter to be able to play in time with what I couldn't see was going on behind me. No rhythm track going tss, 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 because that would just annoy the shit out of everybody. And I tried doing a bit of rappy singing version of it. Doesn't work in that sense. Because it's prose rather than poetry, I suppose. So I then created this piece, and then it's got four songs in it. Again, the soundtrack was recorded without the vocal. So I would then sing the vocal. So that's in the video as well. I had some mantras in it as well, which were sort of built in as natural breaks for me, which were pre-recorded, but I could choose to say them at the same time. Nobody noticed, nobody cared. Prepare to be frightened, prepare to be scared. Another one was, who died today? Who died today? Who died today? What did the papers say? They said nothing. It was really early, around the whole people dying because of the result of changes to benefits and stuff like that. And this was really prophetic. 6, 7, 8 years after I'd written it, people were still saying, how do you see all this back then? I haven't. Nothing's changed. It's just that other people now see it, if that makes sense. All the things we could have been, too. So I created this show, which, when I do it as a solo show, it's about 1 hour and 10 minutes. People that have seen it, it might not be the most polished piece of art, and it's so long that I don't know it off by heart, but I don't pretend to. I bought myself a massive big black book, and I use it, kind of doomsday thing. I read through it, but make it part of the performance. And it's amazing when it's there how little you do look at it, because you just need to see little bits of it. And so the show ends up, so there's me as the only live person, as it were, the video running with music tracks in it where appropriate, and the sign language interpreter, and then there are three guests. When the landlord speaks as the narrator, there are various other references about who I am and how I see my people. But then comes this whole thing about my people and being the activist disabled population. It covers this huge breadth of things, from euthanasia and aborting disabled fetuses through to careers offices. And there's a massive thing of what life is as a disabled person. One song is sung by a young woman who genuinely has paraplegia, but her title in the show is Miss Paralysis, and she does this heavy rock rap. And then my son Josh, who is also a wheelchair user, plays the character of the Little Limerick Laureate. He delivers 6, 7, or 8 really completely un-PC, disability-focused limericks. And the biggest, probably the longest separate section, which is about halfway through, is a story called The Red Hand from Ulster. And it tells the story of the hand that went on to live for time immemorial, having been chopped off and thrown on the shore. It's a little baby story of absolute independence. Even if you're only a hand, if you learn how to live, you can do it on your own. You can live. It's written in chapters, so it's not just an 80,000-word poem. So you can use any given chapter as the beginning for a workshop. So whether you're doing disabled people, or social workers, or whoever, it's there, and it's a real strong critique. A lot of people are like, really? Of what? Particularly when they're not disabled people. The Impact. There is a chapter called The Impact, and actually it's all about my realization as a late teenager of what Michael Oliver called the social model, which I was living long before I had the name, but in terms of being able to externalize it, literally on stage, it hit me like a slap in the face. It's both a positive and a negative realization, because it goes on to focus on the fact that, okay, you can feel better, that it's not you who says that. You go through that externalization from self-blame to what's been done to me. But actually, is that recognition any more comfort? Because people do not want you, do people not like you because of your disability? There is a real sting in the tail of that self-realization. Sometimes, while it's not in the play, the whole idea of ignorance being bliss, maybe it is, maybe and not always. I've been accused, I can remember, but if you tell people that, they're going to be more unhappy as they realize that they're being discriminated against. Yeah, but I'm still going to tell them. So there is that sort of double-edged sword to it. Omnibus. I thought this needs to come out again. What shall I do with it? So then I thought this moves on to then becoming the omnibus. I then put a proposal to Ace to use the original performance piece as the introduction to a series of creative writing, creative discovery workshops. They were 8 weeks long, one day a week. I got the money and booked out rehearsal space and the end of course performance in the main auditorium. We did one at New Hampton Arts Centre in Wolverhampton, and then the second one at a place called the Blue Orange, which is an independent theatre in Birmingham. I would perform the piece in its original format, and then have the discussions about how did that make you feel. The purpose was that then each of the people that were in the cohort devised themselves a character, and then that got slotted into the main performance. So from the original narrative, I would then adjust the little bits to be able to fit in, change some of the continuity so the whole play still started at one point and finished at the same end point. The play opens with the song What Could Have Been, and finishes up with the song Don't Ever Give Up. I brought in a dramaturg as well, who helped with running, giving people some performance and drama skills. Guy called Patrice Nyambana, who's pretty well known. He did what I asked him to do, but he became so engaged by the process that he came up to me and said, "Can I have a part in this? I want to write my own piece and put it in." And he came in as this kind of African overlord, came on stage with an AK-47 and an anti-Mugabe t-shirt and all kinds of things. So then the show ended up going from 1 hour and 10 minutes to being a show in 2 halves, which ended up being 2 hours and 20 minutes. And then the band that is now Angry Fish, became creators in their own right and had their own spoken word pieces within the broader thing. The songs became played live, and then we had to use an interpreter. She was lovely. She was really good. But she's a proper arts interpreter, not just someone from the local list of interpreters. And that was amazing. And people were like, "When can we do the next thing? When can we do the next thing?" But you can't do the same thing again, no matter how fucking well it works. From the grants for the arts thing, it just seems it's gotta be, it's gotta change, it's gotta move, it's gotta evolve. From my point of view, there's 10,000 disabled people who could benefit from taking part in this and learn about themselves. And all of this goes under the banner of the Y Festival. Whatever I do, if I'm doing anything public, there's more than me being asked to go and do something. It comes under the Y Festival. Big Angry Fish. I don't hide behind my guitar, but it's a barrier, if you like. It's the protection as a performer. And when I sing a lot of the time, so I think not so much now, but there've been various points where I go on stage and I am being Angry Fish, as opposed to Robin Surgeon over the guitar. So you're stepping into that character and putting on the armour that that character delivers to be able to go out there, and often do things, bits of performance, that are really quite questioning, undermining, abrasive, as well as it depends on who you are. Because for me, if you're a disabled person and you understand where I'm coming from, or begin to, you see it as an uplift, you see it as a fillip, you see it as solidarity and cohesion. Fascist fucking. We'd entered this battle of the bands, and one of the bands, and their very physical supporters, were obviously a right-wing band. And we went on, and you could hear from the crowd, what are they doing on there? They should be in homes, put them in hospitals. Them not knowing that, my brother-in-law and his mates were all about 6'3". They had this big band of them. They're not rugby players, but fucking big guys. So I changed our set and then finished with this song, Fascist Fucking, which is an out-and-out punk song. The chorus is something like, you've got to screw these fascist morons and their politics of perfection. You've got to demonstrate how wrong they are through rioting imperfection. You've got to take these dickheads by the throats and throttle their obsessions. I was so cross, and the band, I don't care, you said we've got to do it, we'll do it. And then they got really cross, and the other band were on after us, and there was an absolute ruck. Because when we'd got off, and they knew we were safely off stage, our supporters, this other band came on and were trying to give it some, and they just went in and kicked the shit out of them. I don't condone violence, but there was a certain retribution needed at that point, in a not hospitalisation sense. But you can get away with a lot in a mosh pit that you really shouldn't, shall we say. The last time ever I saw your face. Then I wrote Black Thursday. Black Thursday is the title track, and it's all about election days. But there's a song in there called The Last Time Ever I Saw Your Face. The premise of the song is that you should never go out of the front door, or close the bedroom door, or storm out of an office, or whatever, without resolving an argument. Because you never know what's going to happen the other side of that door, the other side of that argument. And so the story's about loss, and it finishes with the line, and we never got a chance to say goodbye. I remember one of the first times I did it was at one of the early Y Festival performances, and Crip Hop were there. Sasha, who plays the psycho, his stage name is Psycho, just massive big German guy, comes from a mental health background. He said, you bastard. I said, what? He said, how am I supposed to go on stage? I've been crying. I listened to that song in the green room and I was in tears. I can't always play it. If I'm in the wrong mood, I can't play it because if I am feeling a bit vulnerable, I'll choke halfway through. It's that powerful, and it's not even... It is real because it's real, in the sense of it's not one person's story. It's many people's stories. Far Q. There's a song on Black Thursday called Far Q, which is all about the experiences of music festivals. It's probably the one comedy song I've written, which goes down well when you've got a good audience. They pick it up almost instantly. The first verse goes, I was trying to park my motor at V just the year before. People climbing out of camper vans and falling to the floor. So I asked the parking marshal what I should do. He said, there's parking over there for the likes of you. But when I saw where he was pointed and what I had to do, I turned back to the marshal and said, fuck you. And then it's 12 bar or 16 bar, but then it comes back in with, he said you what, I said fuck you. He said you what, I said fuck you. He shook his head, he said, you come to these events, you expect us to provide a wheelchair tent. And then it kind of goes on like that, and then each line ends with fuck you, but without actually saying it. And then I do it, and I do it. And people pick it up, really, really. It's just there's a stop, so it goes. And I was talking to the marshal, and I said, then the music stops, and I go, fuck you. But the very last line says, the service and the atmosphere are just crap. So you loose your tongue and loose your mouth and shout, this is really bad service. And whatever it is, whatever comes out at the end line, it's not what the whole audience has gone, fuck you. And I go, no, rude. And I'll add a bit on at the end. Rights and responsibilities. I think everybody needs to know what their rights are. We are supposedly born with inalienable human rights. Unless you're born a disabled person or you acquire an impairment. And then apparently that inalienable ability gets zapped away. But at the same time, if you embrace your rights, you have to do it in a way that you have to be responsible for how you then fight for your rights or engage in your rights. And therefore, you have to be responsible about your actions in pursuance of your rights. What I always liked about Dan historically was it was non-violent public demonstration. You know, chaining yourself to a bus isn't violent. Holding a placard isn't violent. But for me, when they were going to go to such and such and throw red paint, no, because that's not responsible. For me, you know, some people would call me a Jesse if I say I'm not doing that. And in the same way as I'm not going to put a bomb under the Houses of Parliament. Because there is a point, if you start down that road, where does that road end up? It ends up in civil war and terrorism. And that might sound really dramatic, but I think that you can't expect people to treat you. If you want your rights and you want to be treated in a way that befits those rights, you have to behave in a way that befits those rights. Does that make sense? To have rights, you have to respect other people's rights. And that's where the responsibility comes in. For me, there is a big difference. Freedom to speak and freedom of speech. And for me, freedom, the freedom of speech, doesn't mean being allowed to impinge on someone else's liberty. It's that kind of, you've got to be really careful. That what you don't do in the fight for your rights is end up creating your own kind of mob mentality. I would never want to do that. I would like to see. I think if I was to say, what do I think of disability arts now? I would like to see us getting back to the opportunity for disabled people to celebrate with each other inclusively. But what I really feel what's been lost was that momentum of who we are. You know, when it seems it's utterly okay in the able-bodied arts world to have cabaret, yet it's like, oh no, we've done that in disability art. You can't do that anymore. Well, why not? People loved it. You can't have mixed cohort events. You can't have comedians on with poets and bands and do disability art within it. 'Cause you can't. I would love to see that back. All the stuff that we did as the DAFs was fabulous. And that somehow got lost in the misunderstanding of inclusion.